coming up on this edition of Open Source.
Artificial intelligence goes all the way from predicting consumer behaviors based on a set of current behavioral models and helping you to find an easier way to live your life. Now, there's obviously good and bad in that scenario.
Up next on Open Source, marketing guru Mark Brogdon on the changing world of technology, marketing, and entertainment. Welcome to Open Source. My guest today is Mark Brogdon, President and CEO of NTU Creative Marketing Group, an award-winning marketing agency. And Mark, you've got multiple ventures, a tremendous career, awards everywhere.
Tony, I'm so honored and appreciative to be on your show. So first of all, thank you so much for having me.
Well, I appreciate you being here. I know that you've had a diverse career, and but you're really known primarily as a marketer and an exceptional marketer. And even in the last 12-month period, you've won 3 awards. Tell me about the awards that you won and the campaigns and projects that those awards were for.
So, you know, one of the honors that you have in this business is to be recognized by your peers, obviously, as if you were, you know, an actor to an Academy Award, an Oscar. The Telly Awards is a preeminent award for anybody in my field. And, you know, we're up against some heavy talent. You know, Unilever is probably going to send, you know, Axe body spray to the awards, and they're going to, you know, so as a marketer, you're honored when, you know, people in your peer group as a small agency recognize your dedication, your achievements in this industry. So for me, you know, I take an approach. NTU is the letter N, the numeral 2, the letter U, Creative Marketing Group. And I call it that because I try to get individual or individualize each campaign. I don't do a cookie cutter approach to any client. So one of the clients that I won an award for is in New York. It's the Encourage Kids Foundation. It is a foundation that helps medically challenged kids live a better life. And one of the things that we had decided on is we wanted to gain better awareness for this foundation worldwide. They are, you know, affecting 1.8 million kids in hospitals every year. So we built a campaign around a strategy of kids that are breaking barriers. They were approached by a martial artist named Lef Becker, who currently had the world record for the number of boards he had broken in any 24-hour period. I mean, sorry, any one-minute period of time. He had broken 480 boards in a minute. And he wanted to break that record by 24 hours. And so he approached the foundation and said, hey, I would like to attach this foundation to this world record-breaking initiative. And they called me. They were a client of mine. They called and said, hey, we don't know what this means for us as a foundation, but if you can figure something out and create a campaign and an awareness campaign, and obviously we'd love to get donations out of it as well, we'd be honored to hire your agency to do so. So I took 24 hours and I thought about it, and I said, hey, well, you know, this guy is breaking boards with his hands for 24 hours, and that's already a unbelievable feat to even consider. Kids in hospitals are also trying to overcome obstacles. So if I can marry the two in some kind of campaign, I think we got a winner here. So we went to Ripley's Believe It or Not and said, hey, we'd like to have this this world record-breaking event here at Ripley's Believe It or Not in Times Square. Would you agree? Well, Ripley's had never been open 24 hours ever before, but they agreed to allow us to do this in the lobby for 24 hours. Hurdle one. Next, we tried to figure out how could we make this thing as big as possible to affect the kids. So we went to pediatric hospitals all around the country, and we allowed the kids to paint and draw their own boards of their own illnesses, so cancer, leukemia. And those boards would eventually be used in this world record-breaking competition or event, so that he would both metaphorically and realistically break their barriers. Then we went to ABC News and decided, hey, well, this is so big at this point. Is there any way we could get ABC involved and that they would, you know, exhibit this for 24 hours on ABC News, to which they agreed to do so. So now we're, you know, at a place in which it just became huge. So we have all elements covered from print, you know, PR, live exhibition and everything. So our award winning scenario yielded us over 200 million impressions across the world and raised a lot of money for the organization as well as awareness. So I've won two awards for both its effect on the social, the live exhibition, and then won another award for another campaign that I did for its, again, live exhibit. So we were really excited over the last couple of years to continue to be recognized by our peers for what we contribute to marketing.
That is an awesome event, and I mean, an amazing undertaking. How long did it take you to put that together?
So from concept to activation was probably 8 months. And, you know, it was quite laborious. In addition to my agency, we enlisted another agency, which was Geometry Global, or Gray Advertising, who built a lot of our creative. And we, you know, I oversaw three different PR firms. And so it became a team that, again, they called me the quarterback because I had to oversee all of the from concept to through activation. But it was an amazing feat.
Now, if you're a marketer, especially contemporary marketer, we call it the science of marketing. And a lot of people laugh at that. But explain the science of marketing to our listeners, Mark.
So marketing and advertising, which are, you know, cousins at best, is really the psychology of the consumer. We control consumer behavior in a lot of things we do. You ever, you know, see a, listen to a record, you listen to it so many times, you hate it the first time, and then, you know, after hundreds of spins, you can't get it out of your mind. We control consumer behavior through advertising and marketing and communications. So that's where the science comes in. There is truly a science involved, although, you know, a lot of people look at marketing as the fun aspect, especially experiential marketing, which is event marketing. They look at that as the party. You know, that's the culmination of, you know, everything that people want to go to, be at, and be involved in. But there's a definite, you know, cookie hiding in the backdrop of everything that we do that drives consumers awareness and or behavior. And that's what the science part of it is. You know, there are a lot of scientists that don't realize that they're scientists. Young people who are now on social media, they've learned the craft of communication through short bites of communication and conversation that can direct audiences into either perception and or buying. So a like is equivalent to a buy in some people's minds. So they understand the science, and but they don't know what they're doing at this point. Some of them don't. So that's where we are as scientists, and that's why we get paid to do what we do.
Absolutely. Now, for you, you had an interesting journey to where you are now in Los Angeles. But to talk about how you went from in the automotive industry to the entertainment industry, so to speak, and what kind of decisions you had to make along the way to get to where you are now.
So, Tony, I appreciate you asking that question because this, you know, when I speak, you know, I'm a public speaker, and when I speak, I talk about this journey because it's a culmination of a lot of things that's got us here. I started in Detroit with General Motors and Saturn. I was the first national spokesperson and product specialist for Saturn Automotive, which was a division of General Motors. And they relocated me to California to help start the automotive, brand new automotive company. It was the first automotive, brand new automotive company in 65 years, all American. They brought me out here. And after 2 years of the sun and fun, I'll say I was called to come back to Michigan to do a branding initiative with the Santa Cycling Team. It was 85 degrees out here and 45 in Detroit. So, you know, I opted to stay in California, which, you know, at the first I thought it was probably a bad decision, but it was probably the best decision to start me on the trajectory of my life. I left Saturn and was blessed enough to get a job with the Disney Channel in 1992. And the benefit of that is that that's early telephony, that's early digital compression, and understanding, you know, not just what makes a good show on television, but what is the science behind what we now know as streaming and what we now know as digital television. So I was an early adopter into that. And I think, you know, my communication skills and my ability to, you know, multitask with Saturn, you know, made me a benefit to that organization at Disney, but it taught me a new skill set. So, you know, I was excited to not only learn, you know, in Detroit, automotive at the time was the predominant industry, as it probably still, you know, to some degree still is. In Los Angeles, the industry is entertainment, and Hollywood is entertainment. So to be on top of the game in both cities and the number one industry in each city, respectively, you know, was something that I was honored to take that and run with it.
You talked about Disney and streaming and all these things, and I know that right now OTT, which is over-the-top television, basically streaming, has become the new game. And how has OTT changed media, changed advertising, changed the game?
Well, you know, as a marketer, you start to understand, as we talked about a little while ago, consumer behavior. And as a futurist, and we'd like to consider ourselves futurists, you have to kind of look into consumer past, present, and then understand the future of consumption for content. This was inevitable that we would get here. The coronavirus, COVID-19, accelerated where we are today in terms of streaming. So let me explain where that conversation really has to go. We started to notice a decline in traditional theatrical. People weren't going to the theaters as much. The consumer experience for theatrical release was, you know, starting to take a downward spin based on people having OTT or over-the-top or streaming options and a variety of entertainment options from the computer to the phone and now Netflix and streaming services. We probably looked at it as a 2-year, you know, run that, you know, would probably be the most hit a peak or plateau maybe 1 to 2 years from now. As a result of Corona and COVID-19 and people being forced to stay in and not having those entertainment options to go to a theatrical, we've now accelerated where we were going to be in 2 years. Futurists, we understood we'd get here, but we didn't know it'd be this fast. So people are now catching up to either Universal, Sony, and some of the big movie houses, giving what would have been a first one-run release in theatrical, sending it directly to Netflix or another streaming service. And it's changing the game. It's changing the game. It's changing the revenue models. It's changing how production companies have to forecast. It's changing how actors have to think about their lives. You know, musicians and soundtracks. We're seeing a whole shift in the industry. And again, like music was before CDs and digital downloads of music, we're at that same apex. And, you know, some streaming services were prepared for it and some studios were not. So that's kind of where we are now.
And that's interesting, too. I look at this as not just a bad set of circumstances, because it is. This virus is presented to everybody. But what are the opportunities now that are happening because of COVID-19?
So, you know, again, I think we don't know all of the opportunities. You know, there is no crystal ball. But if I were to guess, I think that artificial intelligence and virtual reality is going to be our wave of the present, not even far future. The ability to have an experience virtually without leaving the house would be the equivalent of, at one point we had to go to go to Las Vegas to see a professional fight. And if you didn't do that, then you hear it on the radio, or, you know, at best catch it, you know, in the newspaper 2 days later. Well, you know, when pay-per-view, you know, allowed you to pay and watch a fight in your living room with, you know, 100 of your best friends, or go to a bar and watch it, it changed the paradigm of how we could exhibit and experience and socialize without having to be at the live event. I think we're going to get closer to that as a model with now coronavirus being, you know, a position that we're put in to, you know, be forced to stay home and not to socialize. So we're going to have to find different opportunities, a way to virtually socialize. And I think that in that matrix is where we find our profit center, and that's where we find our opportunities. Who's going to be the first to perfect the way that we socialize without physically being in the same room? You know, I think D. Nice, and you'll probably hear his name come up through a lot of your different conversations, kind of set a model, an early version of a model of how we have learned that we can socialize, you know, in our remote location and be around a million people and not touch. So I think that, and if you don't know what I'm referring to, D. Nice, you know, as a DJ, and he went on Instagram and did a series of Instagram, you know, DJ sessions that nearly a million people tuned in to listen to, and their comments in their feed made it feel as though you were in the room or at a club with Halle Berry and with Oprah Winfrey and every other celebrity around the world. So
Michelle Obama, yeah, and J-Lo, yeah, and everybody else. So right. So now you mentioned artificial intelligence, and just because we're running out of time, but just touch on that. How are people experiencing artificial intelligence right now?
So we you know, were, as we were with e-commerce in the early 2000s, we were scared to put our credit card online, and then, you know, we're now at a point in Amazon that we obviously, you know, live on, you know, buying things online. So we were the same place with artificial intelligence. We didn't want to feel that the government could listen to our conversations and anticipate what our consumer habits would be, so as to make it easier for us to continue to shop, to live, and everything else. Artificial intelligence is coming now to the point that you have an appliance who can listen to your conversation, who can understand that your refrigerator is becoming empty, order everything, go directly to the store, and it gets shipped to your house. So I think that, you know, again, artificial intelligence goes all the way from predicting consumer behaviors based on a set of current behavioral models and helping you to find an easier way to live your life. Now, there's, you know, obviously good and bad in that scenario. And until we become completely comfortable with it, they're going to be distractors who don't want that to happen. They're going to feel, you know, very invaded upon. But it's happening already all around you. When you go to the airport and you have clear, you're able to show your retina scan, you know, they can already know that, and that comes to a set of circumstances to let people know where you're traveling, how long you're going to be gone, and everything else. So it's all around us, and everywhere we go, it's a matter of how you accept it and how you maximize opportunities to utilize it.
Now, one of the things that you're involved in, and one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you, is the Pan-African Film Festival. And explain about what that's about, yes, and then how it's being impacted by these coronavirus. And so what are you going to do in response to that?
So for you, those of you that don't know what the Pan-African Film Festival is, go to PAFF.org, PAFF.org, and check us out. But Pan-African Film Festival is the third largest film festival in the world. We boast of about 130,000 people over 12 days of amazing independent films from all around the diaspora. You know, we are, again, as a futurist, as we talked about a little while ago, we have to anticipate that this coronavirus is going to not only affect us now, because we're in our planning stages for our 29th year of the film festival, which happens every February. It's the largest Black history month event in the world. So we have to try to plan and anticipate, is this even going to happen? I just read an article today in the New York Times that talked about even Cannes is postponed and all the major film festivals may not happen. The Academy Awards, which may not happen, may have to double up from 2020 and 2021 movies to even have a effective show maybe in into 2021 or 22. So we're going to get hit hard if the consumers don't want to even come to the festival. Although we may be open and the society is ready to get back outside, there are going to be a lot of people who may not feel comfortable because we've now changed their behavior. They may not feel comfortable getting in large environments. So we now, as we talked about in the past, have to create a streaming version or an online version of our festival to coincide with the brick and mortar version. So in anticipation that if the brick and mortar does not happen, we still have a presence. After 29 years of distributing amazing films from all around the world, you know, there's a need and a want and a desire to see this product. Netflix just opened up a whole new African division on Netflix. So we know that the content wants to be consumed. We just may not be able to put it live again as we did in the past. And so we're working on those options right now.
Okay. So then you're looking at what's going to happen in the next cycle for the festival. And so would the plan be at that point to create a virtual film festival?
So we're working on now. So regardless if the doors are open or not, I'm still creating a virtual festival because, you know, festivals submissions start in June. Last year, we reviewed over 1,200 films, a record number of submissions. And we accepted 225 films in the festival. So that has to take place over a six-month period. So we're starting that now. But understanding that, you know, there's been no precedent for this in the past. So we have to now review all of our agreements with filmmakers to say, hey, you know, this may be a live exhibition. This may be a live exhibition and a digital exhibition, or it may just be a digital exhibition. So know that all of that has to go into planning now. You know, this corona is going to hit a lot of people that we don't think about. You know, what about our popcorn makers? What about our vendors? What about even our, you know, ticket takers? So there's so many people that we're trying to figure out how do we replace that, you know, our revenue for them and us, you know, during this 12-day festival. So there's a lot of planning that goes on that there's no precedent for.
Now, that's interesting. We talked earlier about films and theatrical films being moved directly to Netflix or to other streaming platforms. How are studios going to recoup any of the revenue that they expect from theatrical releases as they go to streaming services? How's that going to work?
So, you know, again, that model is a work in progress. Disney's big summer release, they took it straight to digital, and they boasted of the highest revenue for a streaming film ever released. They did not release the numbers, so we don't know if it, you know, if it made the money that they would have made on a theatrical release. You know, when you have a film that goes into streaming for $19.95 or $20, and four people in the house could potentially watch it, well, you've missed, you know, the equivalent of $60 in ticket sales. You know, Netflix is still getting $8.99 to $12.99 a month in subscription fees on top of that. So that may have to be a better revenue share model with the theatrical companies because this is a subscription-based service. So, you know, this is a hybrid model. We have to figure it out. I mean, in every theatrical model, there was, you know, your home entertainment, which at one point was a DVD model, and then cable. You know, there was revenues that they shared with cable television after home entertainment. So, you know, there's a cycle that probably is just going to miss one major part of it, which is, and that's more of a promotional part, which is the theatrical release.
And we also, I think, considering this, that as this virus goes on, production has stopped for some programs and films or whatever, and that means production didn't even start for others. At some point, is it possible that we will run out of content?
Well, that's to assume that we never come back, so I don't think we'll ever run out of content. You know, you can make content on your cell phone these days. Fortunately, there are a variety of opportunities to make and deliver content. The kind of big blockbuster content may take a hit, but then that may take a hit for several reasons. You know, we can't pay actors, you know, $20 million, understanding that our revenue stream is not to support it. You know, TNA or print and advertising is going to change. So do we still need to put in that much money in print and advertising if people don't have as many options and can just turn it on TV? So, you know, we look at this and we're evaluating this hybrid of revenue as this continues to evolve. And, you know, you made a statement a minute ago, if this lasts a long time. Well, you know, I remember the push-up challenge, for instance, and they told us that they wanted us to do 20 days of push-up challenge because people and consumer behavioral habits change after 20 days. So as we look at being in this corona, you know, virus scenario, the stay-at-home effect for over 20 days, we're going to have a shift in our behavior. So even if this thing ends in July or August or September, we'll have a new normal that we're now comfortable with. So people might not go back to the theaters regardless if they're open or not. You know, if you're required to sit...
I agree. And I think that even people with pre-existing conditions and have compromised immune systems may not be able to participate in society openly like they did before, even if other people are able to go to a game, you know, where they maybe have fewer fans. But people that have those situations where they're in danger, they're not going to be able to do that.
That's probably the obvious audience. But then think about this. We're working out of our homes now. And if I am as productive working out of my home as I am in the office, and, you know, my office starts to look at productivity versus, you know, how much it would cost to house me in the office with a secretary, with all the supplies and everything else, if I can do that as just effectively below lower cost, that's the new normal. So we're going to see a shift in industry that we may not go back to the way that we've done things in the past. And again, you asked about artificial intelligence. Well, you know, Zoom is an example of how we now can communicate as a conference call, a face-to-face conference call. And technology is now going to accelerate the things that we can do that that's our new normal. And I know that's...
And I think we've seen already, if you look at news programs where broadcasters have broadcast from their basements or their living rooms, the first week or two was pretty rough. Lighting was poor, sound was poor. But as we've gone into week three, week four, that's changed dramatically. You can't tell, for some of them, you can't tell whether they're at home or actually
exactly.
In studio.
And again, you asked me at one point what the opportunity could be as we go further into this scenario. The opportunity is the first person that can come up with the app or the system, which is just as effective as being in a studio at your home. It could be a home green screen that when you shoot it, it looks like you're still in the CNN studios. And then has a split screen that has no line in it that allows you to interview somebody as if they're in the studio with you. Those are your opportunities now. You know, who's our technology partners, you know, that can develop that? Who's our technology partner that allows us to know everybody that is tuning in, you know, our Nielsen ratings on a virtual call? That's where I'm telling you.
These are all exciting times, Mark. I mean, it's crazy. And I really appreciate having someone with your level of expertise on the open source program. And we are out of time, but I really, again, thank Mark Brogdon for being with us. Mark is the president and CEO of NTU Marketing. It's the letter N, the number 2, and the letter U, and a creative marketing group, I should say. And Mark, thanks for being on Open Source.
And I appreciate you. When everybody listens, please go to NTUCMG.com, NTUCMG.com, to just find out more about what we're doing. And Tony, you have an amazing show, and I look forward to seeing it grow.
Thank you so much. This is Open Source with Tony Motley, and that's it for this time. Thank you. Open Source is a production of Duet Digital Media and McLaughlin Media.